Chaos. Woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning, chilling with coffee mugs, me and coffee chugs, talking education all across the nation, pushing boundaries, thinking innovation. Chaos.
Hello everyone, how you doing? Welcome to another episode on Living on the Edge of Chaos podcast. Guys, I'm kind of like fanboying here a little bit, and so I got to make sure I keep my fan energy at a low here and keep my cool. This is such a privilege to have this guest on the show today. This is someone who has just done such incredible work, and when she introduces herself here in a minute, if you're in education and don't know her, I'm not sure what rock you've been under, but you have probably in some shape or form used her work, seen her work, read her work, applied her work, whether you realize it or not. And she, along with one of her colleagues, has just come out with a new book among many incredible books that she has published throughout her career, A Shift Writing into the Classroom with UDL and Blended Learning, which just blew my mind in the sense of just recalibrating the essence of education and why we do what we do. And I'm talking today with none other than the holy guacamole, the awesome Dr. Catlin Tucker. So thank you so much for jumping on this show. I am so pumped when you said yes. I was like, all right, when I saw the email. So in case people don't know who you are and what you do, who are you? What do you do? And what in the world do you got going on?
I am an educator. I spent 16 years in a high school English language arts classroom. I have done coaching for probably a decade now, supporting teachers. My area of expertise is blended learning, but that's kind of the tip of the iceberg. I do a lot with blended learning and, you know, student-centered learning. Now my work with Dr. Novak has really opened the door of kind of the synergy between those things and universal design for learning. Obviously, now I am knee-deep in artificial intelligence, and I have the privilege of teaching future educators as well and traveling all over the world to work with teachers to kind of reimagine how we design and facilitate learning.
I love that. And, you know, your latest work, what drew me to it, I've always followed your work, but this one is I've been knee-deep in the AI world. I think many people have, or they soon will be. And so when I saw the book that you and Dr. K. Novak put together and about writing, and then kind of that layered in with AI, I was like, oh my gosh, I have got to get a hold of this. And the book resonated so well, because I think, and you can jump in, you are obviously the author of this, like, it's not so much like, hey, here's 100 ways in which to use AI. Like, it's not that. There are applications, don't get me wrong, but you get back to the core of, I know, of sound, fundamental, research-based, instructional practices that we need to go back and address and infuse and utilize. And you can layer those practices with AI when relevant. And so to me, that is, I think, the conversation we need to be having more of in schools, in districts, all levels. I mean, I live and breathe in the K-12 space, but even, you know, at the higher end, can you talk a little bit more about, like, not how the idea formed, but the importance of not losing sight, or as people say, throwing the baby out with the bathwater? Because I think this is the first book I've read that isn't like, AI is so amazing, here's 400 tools, or not, or AI is the end of the world and we're all going to be, you know, unemployed and miserable. Like, this is a very practical approach to getting back to, like, the roots of what works.
Well, thank you. I remember the moment when I had the idea for the book. I had woken up really early in the morning, and I write about this in the introduction, of just receiving a handful of text messages from people in my life about ChatGPT. And from that kind of beginning stage of hearing about artificial intelligence, and the explosion, all of the conversation was just so negative. Oh, there goes the essay. The essay is never going to be a vehicle to assess student learning anymore. And we'll never be able to trust kids. We ask them to write. And I just had this moment every time I heard a statement like that where I thought, yeah, if we're sending writing home with kids, right? Writing is a cognitively challenging task. There are a host of equity issues that need to be considered when we send those kinds of tasks home with students. And they've just had long days in school. And now you're asking them to go home. Hopefully they have a quiet space. Hopefully they have a dedicated device to do this writing. But like, are they excited about the prompts? Are they interested, invested? Or are they just trying to get it off their plate? Because if they're not invested, if it's not relevant, if they don't feel supported or really know what they're doing, of course they're going to leverage something like AI to produce something so they can just move on. And my thought was like, AI is not the problem. How we're using class time is the problem, because writing is a skill like any other skill, but so little explicit instruction in classrooms is focused on writing. And so students are asked to produce writing. They haven't seen exemplars that they've looked at and analyzed and talked about. They may not know what the success criteria or, you know, different rubrics for learning, you know, assessing learning and writing might look like. And so we're just like throwing them these challenging tasks without any support. And I thought, what if Katie and I worked together to write a book that really broke down the parts of the writing process, from analyzing exemplars for different kinds of writing in math and in science, history, English, really understanding what does this writing look like? What seems to be the common characteristics, and then moving through each piece of the writing process, from pre-writing to getting feedback on writing to reflecting and self-assessing writing. And so as we were fleshing out the book too, I said, you know, I know everybody's going to be excited about leveraging AI as a tool in the classroom. I know there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of teachers who don't necessarily spend time using AI. They might not really understand what it's all about. Yet it's this incredibly powerful tool. So anybody who's read Katie and my first two books will know that each of the books kind of starts with, or each of the chapters in our book starts with an anecdote. We have this research and reflect, or research and reality section. And then we have a collection of strategies for teachers to choose from, because just like there's student variability, there's teacher variability. So we wanted them to have different strategies they can pull from depending on their preferences and their students. And one strategy in each chapter is an AI enhanced strategy, just trying to highlight how this could be leveraged in classrooms as a thought partner, a writing assistant, and a 24/7 feedback tool.
Thanks for explaining that. I'm sure you've had to explain that a million times, but I think it's so perfect to set the stage for the things, because I think regardless of where an educator or anybody reading material sits in the AI world, whether you're on board, off board, confused, excited, whatever it might be, the key here that I think when I'm doing AI presentations, and I've done probably well over 30 in the schools that I support in my job, there is a lot of pushback on the idea of AI. Cheating, plagiarism, kids are they're not learning, they're already lazy. Whether they say they'll think it's that directly or not, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. What I think they're really saying, but they're not ready to acknowledge, is that AI is that reflection piece that maybe their instructional practices are not as sound as they would like to think. I'm not here pointing fingers saying teachers are bad. That's not my point. So I don't want the hate mail. My thing that I'm talking about is we also have to look at how are our operations? What are we doing and what could we be doing to strengthen our instructional practices or classroom environment where the plagiarism isn't even an issue anymore? And that's what I loved so much about the book, is that, like, that idea about homework. Do we need homework? That should be in the classroom through, and then the 18 million strategies of station rotation and blended learning and UDL, these things that you can tangibly do. You have probably been shown how to do it, or you can easily find, I don't know, you guys have a few resources on how to do that, that it doesn't even become an issue anymore. Because the idea of cheating is not a new revelation because of AI. It's been around, but yet that panic is there. I get why it's there. But it's like, how do we help shift people to be like, maybe this is more about your practices? That's hard to do because that feels personal, but that's what I love so much about your book. I was like, these are things that we can do no matter what we teach, which I think is key to eliminate that whole entire stress.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a really good point that I talk about a lot in my work, which is I think that the way we are designing, the majority of teachers are designing learning experiences is just not flexible enough, right? There's all of these threats, whether it was COVID or whether it's AI, sometimes even things like language diversity in a classroom is a threat to that whole group teacher-led, teacher-paced lesson because it is not flexible enough to meet the demands of the diversity in our room, to meet or kind of address some of these external threats that are kind of perceived by educators. And so, yeah, I run into this all the time in my work with teachers who they were taught to teach a particular way. It's not yielding the outcomes that they're hoping for, that they would like. You know, teachers are working so hard not to be getting better outcomes. And we have a ton of kids who report kind of negative feelings about school. And so it's like, of course, something needs to change. But you're right. It's scary to change. A lot of teachers are comfortable with the way they teach. There's a lot of kind of really ingrained mindset kind of ideas and beliefs that are hard to shift.
As you're talking right there, you hit something that I think is really important, at least for me to clarify, is I know how incredibly hard educators work. And by educators, I'm talking classroom teachers, I'm talking paras, I'm talking the coaches, whatever your role is. So it's all encompassing. That burnout is real. That fatigue, that stress, that like losing the joy of why we got into this work is strengthening literally by the day, sometimes by the hour. And I see that time and time again. So this is what I'm about to say next is not because of lack of effort, but it's kind of built on what you're saying. There are more effective methods to help kids be engaged in the learning, also reducing maybe burnout and the frustrations we feel. I don't know how you phrase it. I should have quoted it directly, but this is all kind of hitting from me. But the idea of, say, homework, right? And now I got to go home and take home a stack of papers or whatever the assignment might be. And now I'm up late and now the kids didn't do well or whatever. And I'm giving up, you know, maybe binge watching my show or whatever the thing might be. Like you've self-imposed that, you being the educator, like, you don't have to do that. And what I love so much about not just this book, but all your work is rethinking the classroom experience. Like school doesn't have to suck for the educator or the student. That blended, the station rotation, the engagement.
No, it doesn't.
Just working with kids in small groups for one-on-one and having conversation. I mean, I know I'm preaching to the choir here. Goodness, I learned all this from you. But like, to me, like how I want to like manifest that into more people's brains that like, you're kind of your own worst enemy, but not due to being lazy and not working hard, because you're by far doing that very much so.
I think that there's a lot of fear, right? Everything that we're talking about, everything at the heart of my work is a shift in control, right? Who is the focus of learning? Who is controlling the learning? And right now in a lot of classrooms, it's a teacher. The teacher controls all parts of the classroom experience, right? And they perceive a lot of benefits in doing that, right? It's easier to control the pace at which we're moving through curriculum because they're under just bombastic pressure to cover ridiculous amounts of content in a year. They're in control of, or they feel like they're in more control of classroom management. And the challenge is that to shift to a student-centered, student-led kind of learning environment, you have to release control. That means you have to create a community of learners who understand what are the expectations for me in this room? Have I had a voice as a student in articulating those? What happens if I don't, you know, hold up the agreements that we've decided on in this class, right? I think there, you definitely have to set the stage. And for teachers who are worried about student behaviors, releasing that control and trusting them to manage their own behavior, make responsible choices, right? Complete the work that they're being asked to do. So many teachers are so scared that students won't behave, that they won't do the work, that then, they scoop up massive stacks of literal and digital work and carry it into their lives outside of school to grade, which personally I don't understand, right? Homework, practice, review, these all should be safe spaces to fail and make mistakes. And when we start scooping up that work and putting points and grades on it, we've taken away that safe space to practice and potentially not do well, but learn from that experience. And so I'll talk to teachers about like, what are you taking home and why? Okay. What if you had students doing their own self-assessment and a reflective practice and then offered a skill station for students who were really struggling with some aspect of the assignment and allowed other students to kind of move ahead. And it's just very hard for them to conceptualize an experience that they're not orchestrating part of.
I come from a background, I don't even know if that's the right way of phrasing it, but like I live and breathe in like the project-based learning, design thinking kind of, and purposeful play are like kind of like the hats that how I like to reimagine a learning experience, whether we're in school or out. And as I think through that and I think about your work, I was literally just texting an educator that we've done some work with, and I was like, you need to read this book. Number two, think about how we could leverage these structures and protocols in a way that would only strengthen the learning experience of what we're trying to do more. And by putting these systems in place, the systems being whether that's playlist or the station rotation or however we want to manipulate, depending on the goals that we're after within the part of the project we're after, we actually can provide more agency, more student advocacy for their own learning and thinking. The reflection piece, it gets built in where I feel like we do a pretty good job. There's always room to improve, and this allows, like, it kicks it up a notch. And it's not an add-on. It's actually like, just, we have a phrase, it's how we do business. And so as I was reading through that, and I was just like, man, this is such another recalibration of things. Maybe we know that we haven't always just like intentionally built into the thing. You know, I get caught up like in the PBL thing, like, do we have a good driving question? Do we have a good launch? Like, do we have the space for kids to tinker? By tinker, I don't just mean like with tools and stuff, but tinker with their learning and their self understanding and reading your book and looking to them, like, you know, but we can build this in. And it actually just strengthens everything for everybody involved. And like, it becomes its own like self-sustaining ecosystem, which to me is like the breath of fresh air that I needed. But it's really hard to kind of get some of those experiences into the school day with so much pressure of kind of having our hands tied behind our back and kind of being told this is how we got to do it and when we're going to do it, you know, because that's so much of the nature of education, unfortunately, right now.
No, but you're absolutely right. I think a lot of teachers just don't even feel like they have the space to really shift practice, right? Whether it's because they're being told they have to keep up with rigid pacing guides, whether they have to cover certain amounts of content in certain amount of days. And that really can strip educators of the creativity they need for this design work to really think about, if I was to utilize rotations or a playlist, how might that benefit students? How could I more effectively give them meaningful choice and differentiate things like instruction and modeling sessions? How could I pull feedback loops into the classroom? Because the more of that they're able to do, like you said, the more effective they're going to feel, the more they're going to see students, kind of the light bulbs going off, kids engaging with the learning. But there is a bit of a learning curve. And if you don't feel like you have any time to like invest in that design work, it can be really, really daunting.
So there's kind of two pathways I want to go from here and then kind of weave it all back together. One of this is still sticking then with what we've been talking about with the idea of AI and maybe being a little more explicit with that, in the sense of, as you were grappling with, maybe you weren't grappling, you already knew, the idea of weaving AI into the work that you've been doing for so long. You know, I've been interviewing lots of people, both in education, outside of education, around AI. And more recently, I just had people just like make my head hurt in a really good way of rethinking maybe how I think about AI. I'm curious, as you were thinking through the application, because you give very good tangible examples in the book of how AI could help be a nice lever to the blended or the UDL or station rotation methods or getting feedback. I mean, there's a very practical that isn't going to require another book study or a certificate program. You know, how did you think about that with intentionality? Because I think one of maybe the misconceptions I see is like this promise that it's going to like save time or make life easier. I'm starting to shift away from that. And I know that I have said those words, that it's not really about that. It's about how do we increase our skills? How do we become better as humans, as thinkers, as learners? So it's maybe not something about saving time, but leveraging a technology that can help strengthen whatever our goals are after. Like, as you were thinking through that, I don't know if that makes sense or if it's about as clear as mud. as you were being intentional to what you share, and maybe even from there, you know, how did you think through that? Because I think that'd be really helpful for the listener as they're trying to think about, one, your strategies. We probably already called them out on some things. And then two, thinking about AI, which is yet another maybe stress for a lot of people, trying to connect those dots.
Yeah. So I'm going to approach it from two different angles, which is in the shift, you know, the book Shift Writing into the Classroom. The goal from my perspective with that AI enhanced strategy wasn't just as a teacher tool, but actually how do we help students to use AI in a way that will be meaningful? Not just asking, you know, not just turning over the thinking to AI and having it produce something. But so for example, one of the challenges when we talk about breaking down the writing process is, so as I said earlier, let's let kids engage with exemplars. Well, generating exemplars is time consuming, right? So a nice use of AI from a teacher perspective is to create some exemplars or create, you know, different types of writing at different levels and have kids analyze it. Or, you know, if I'm covering a big umbrella topic and I want students to do a piece of writing, could we teach them how to use AI to develop and craft their own writing prompt within that umbrella, something that they're excited to respond to? So in the book, the goal is really to figure out how educators who are open to using AI with students can really use AI to make students much more capable of leading the learning and driving the learning when it comes to the parts of the writing process. From my perspective on like kind of the broader conversation of AI, it's taken me a minute to figure out how to position my voice in relation to AI. So what I mean is I go on TikTok or Instagram and the conversations I hear or the videos I see on those platforms about AI, at least to this point, the majority are, you know, teachers finding a cool AI ed tech tool or education tool. And they're like, hey, you can just throw in your standard and it will spit out this lesson, or throw in a collection of standards and it'll spit out a unit. And I'm like, ooh, I don't like that. Not that I don't understand why teachers are excited, right? When I was hired as an English teacher my first year, I was literally handed a photocopied list of books and they were like, choose six of these novels to teach. And I was like, awesome, this is not helpful. So AI then would have been great. But what I don't want is for AI to just spit out the kinds of lessons we've always been doing. So the way I've positioned kind of my work in relation to the conversations happening around AI is to just point out that in my work supporting educators in designing with blended learning models, using UDL to make learning more accessible and inclusive and equitable, those were kind of big asks before AI from a design perspective, right? Now I'm asking you to design multiple learning stations or a playlist with a sequence of learning activities. And hey, I want you to build student choice into it and let's personalize and differentiate and do all the things to these experiences. And teachers would just look at me like, I like this idea, but I don't know where you think I have time to do this. And the beauty of AI is that it can actually allow us to take our level of intentionality around design and elevate it in a fraction of the time. And that's really what my work is focused on right now, is like, let's talk about when and why you use certain models and strategies. How do we build in flexible pathways and meaningful choice? And let's do it leveraging some of these AI tools so it doesn't take you very long.
People that can't see, I'm like cheering and applauding. I love it because here's where I've been trying to figure out how to articulate, and not just articulate, but then also support, like put my money where my mouth is. And the work that I do is like, it's not about saving time in the big picture. Like what you're saying is it does. You can do things at a fraction of time. But however, the reason that we want to expedite maybe some of this, I don't want to call it lower level. That's not right. But where we spend so much of our cognitive capacity, right, trying to figure out how do we get five examples? How do we get the differentiation of all the different things? So then when we actually want to get into the space of that, like DOK levels 3 and 4, and that deeper learning and really personal conversations with kids where we can push their thinking, one, we're exhausted or we're out of time. Mm-hmm. And now with AI, we can expedite some of that process so that we can then spend more time doing the things that we've always wanted to do, that the bell happens to ring, or there's not enough time, or I'm just bone tired trying to get the thing lifted off the ground to even get there. As I say, like, it's not about saving time. It is in the sense of things that have taken us forever to do, which has been a barrier, but now is allowing us with that extra time to get to the places that we want to achieve and always have tried to strive for, which is really, really hard to do knowing all the things expected on the education system and teachers and all the variables that come with a class full of kids.
So there are teachers, I'm sure, who are super grateful to have adopted curriculum that they use. But I think that can also lead them to feel like there's one pathway. So even for our teachers who are using adopted curriculum, having AI to just add another pathway, to add an option, to add a scaffold, to kind of, you know, add high interest questions, it's like, whether you're starting from the standards and kind of creating your own lessons from the ground up, or whether we're modifying adopted curriculum, I think your point is exactly right. It's bringing that high level of intentionality, right? Like, teachers know their students best. They know who they're designing for. They know the different levels, the needs, the language proficiencies in their classrooms, the preferences, and AI can help them almost become superhuman in their design work, in a way that allows them to take that knowledge of their student population and take their knowledge of their subject area and pull them together and really create these dynamic student-centered learning experiences in much less time than it would have taken before. And even thinking about things like assessment, I was coaching a high school science teacher, and she wanted to kind of use an authentic kind of performance task style assessment. And I said, why don't we come up with at least one other, if not two other, options for students to choose from. And she had not used AI before. And she was like, I don't have time for that. It was just like big eyes, deer in the headlight. No, Catelyn, I don't want to do that. And I said, let's just use ChatGPT. And she goes, I've never used ChatGPT. And I said, don't worry, let's just use it. Let's take this one performance task you've already designed that you like and you think is solid. Let's let it know, hey, these are the standards or the desired result that we're kind of measuring progress toward. Can you give us some other options of performance tasks that would kind of allow us to measure progress to these same standards or desired results? And she was just blown away. It generated like half a dozen, and we only ended up choosing two, and we had to tweak and modify them a little. But it was just this moment of, so many teachers have been, I think, a little bit hesitant to even check it out, that they don't realize what it can do.
Yeah, it reminds me so much. I was talking to an individual for one of the podcast episodes, not in education at all. And he works with businesses and solopreneurs and stuff. He frames it as tools like ChatGPT, to think of it as the editor of our thinking. And I keep thinking about like that idea or that example you just shared, right? Where we can put something in that we've put in, we can get feedback, we can edit, we can refine, but like it's there to help us kind of further craft the thoughts and ideas, or maybe to organize thoughts or to differentiate. And I kind of like that thing. I think there's that mindset that like you put something in, it's almost like the search engine mindset, like Google, we've come to use all the time. We put something in, and maybe one of those links gives us the answer where we can edit and we can have this conversation and guide and really kind of get to something that would be applicable and helpful to the practice that we're doing, not just spitting out necessarily answers, which I think is what everyone thinks is magically going to happen. It can, but you have to know how to prompt, you have to know how to question and think, you know, and all those things that come with it. And so, you know, as you're talking, it reminds me of get a little like Zen Buddhist here of like the Alan Watts, where, you know, he says, if you want to change the world, start by making your bed. And something that I've been kind of grappling with that is, I was reading one of his books on, it's called The Backwards Law. I don't think he created that, but the idea that the more we pursue something, the more we achieve the opposite of what we truly want. And as I'm thinking about the examples you shared that are helpful, and then I'm also then what maybe come to that was thinking about how we see on the spaces, everybody sharing all these new shiny tools. And is that really what we want? And while I'm with you, I understand why people get excited about the things, but I think if we're not careful, we're going to push the narrative in the wrong direction unintentionally, right? Like, we don't need another version of digitized worksheet packets, you know? And so I think some of these things, these features come in, I know they're exciting and that, but like, what are we trying to achieve, and not lose sight of that in the big picture, whether we're talking AI or not. I mean, these are the conversations we've had when the internet evolved, when Wikipedia was around, when YouTube came. I mean, this is nothing new. Yep. It's just AI is just a lot faster, and the updates and the dopamine hits. Well, at least dopamine for me. Maybe it's stress for others. That I wanted to touch on too before we run out of time, that's connected to the book, but it's another part of the 10,000 hats you wear. You have an incredible podcast. And at the time of this recording, you had one of the greatest conversations I've listened to recently that kind of melted my brain a little bit. And you were speaking with James Anderson on his learnership thing, which I'll put a link in for people and for the podcast and for his work.
It's a fabulous book.
Not to like rehash the whole podcast. People just need to go listen to it and all your episodes. But in there, we've mentioned earlier, student voice and choice. We've talked about agency. We've talked about authentic work. He's got some really, really powerful insights. You know, as you were having that conversation with him and you're thinking about the work you're doing, you know, can where are you at in that headspace in terms of maybe like, I don't want to call it misconceptions, but as we're talking about good practices and not having homework, I think sometimes those words, as you guys had a great conversation around, we use a little maybe too loosely. And so I think as we're thinking about these practices, can we talk a little bit about that too? Because I also think we sometimes maybe give ourselves more credit than maybe what we should as we're thinking about all the things, as well as we're challenging all the systems.
Yeah, no, I thought that was a great conversation. And so James's work really focuses on the idea that like, we don't have a teaching problem. There are tons of very talented, qualified teachers. There's so much money that goes into professional learning to help teachers teach, right? What we have is a learning problem where we have students who are not cultivating the skills we're not helping students proactively cultivate the skills to be learners. Like he talks about, there's this really interesting comparison in the book, and we kind of touch on the podcast where, you know, he talks about the way most people can move their bodies, right? We can walk around, do basic functions, but then you have like elite athletes and dancers who have spent years kind of refining movements and building muscle and training and flexibility. And the same thing was, we're all wired to learn, right? As human beings, but some of us learn how to be really effective learners, and that there are ways to develop those skills in our classrooms and our work with students that we need to be embracing. And he talks about student agency. And I loved his comment that it's not just voice and choice, because it's not going to be powerful if we're simply giving students agency over these trivial decisions, but really they need agency around more challenging aspects of their educational experience, because it's through that agency and grappling with those decisions and the outcomes and their experiences that we are going to cultivate learners who go out into the world believing they can kind of have a change, or they can impact the world, instead of always feeling like things are happening to them or they're the victim of a particular circumstance. Really, we want to like empower them with the knowledge and the skills to go out and thrive in this rapidly changing world. And this idea of not just teaching content or a subject area, but really teaching students, what does it mean to be a learner? What are the skills involved in that? And he has this whole, he builds on Carol Dweck's work, and he has this continuum for growth mindset that I think is fascinating, because he points out so often it's like you either have a growth mindset or you have a fixed mindset. It's this black and white kind of conversation. And yet there's all of these beautiful nuances of gray. And so I just love this idea that, like learning, developing a growth mindset is this continual journey that we're on. There's no like end point to learning. There's no end point to developing a growth mindset. Yeah. His work is fascinating. I love that conversation. And I think the more we leaned into teaching students how to develop the skills of learning, develop that expert learner profile, the more confident and capable and willing they would be to lean into these activities where they're truly leading the learning.
I love that. Thanks for sharing that and expanding upon that, because I know I haven't read his book. I bought it as soon as I was listening to the podcast. I haven't had a chance to dive in, but that conversation resonated. And I would say I would like to pair like his thoughts along with your work too, because I also think there is to some degree an instructional issue too, that like take all your work on blended learning, and even still in this day and age, like people are like, oh, that's great for elementary. Now, let's just take the tried and true thing you heard, you probably heard more of the time than you want to care to admit, and it probably makes you vomit. And then you get to secondary, it's like, oh, well, that doesn't work here. I mean, at the most simplest form, I mean, that conversation has been around for 20 years. I remember hearing that. I remember, heck, I probably said it 20 years ago when I was teaching middle school. So like that is like still like how is that still around? And I'm thinking about those practices and how do we develop that agency and the voice and choice the way he has it defined if we don't have practices in place, which you have a few, that allow for that to happen by creating and shifting the culture of what a learning experience could be. And I paired that with like my own children, who my daughter texted me the other day. I was asking how her day was, and she wasn't very happy. She said 7 class periods in a row where the teachers, all 7, sat at their desk and lectured, never stood up once. And I sit here and I think about, it's not long for she's out into the world and she's going to be fine. I mean, she's got good teachers, and this is coming from her brain. I'm sure there was more than just that. But the notion and idea and the story and the narrative in her head, like school sucks, like they don't care. I think they do care, but whatever it might be, like, but like, and then I read your book and I listen to that podcast, and I'm sitting there going like, she should be having a whole different text response to that question. And yet it's still not happening. And I find that irritating as a parent, and I find it irritating as a person who's passionate about education. And so it's like, to me, I'm just kind of rambling, doing a hot take. Thanks for my therapy session here. Like, it just frustrates me that all this stuff is here, and yet, like, I feel like things aren't shifting, and we know better. And that's where, like, I think this AI, my optimism with AI is that it brings all this stuff and smacks us in the face going, hey, it's time. You know?
I mean, I would just love it to remove some barriers. I mean... I have similar conversations with my son. So I have 2 kids, and my daughter's the kind of learner that you can plop in any environment and she's going to thrive. My son is so social and so extroverted. And so to spend his days in classrooms, the bulk of which are teachers talking, students doing review and practice on their own, is not stimulating. It's not exciting. It's not meeting even just his basic need for social interaction. Yeah. And it's heartbreaking. And I work with teachers every single week, and I work with teachers all over the world. And it really surprises me, given the fact that so many teachers are like, oh, kids aren't engaged. They're not motivated. There's so many problems in my class. And I'm like, okay, so let's reimagine this, and let's try this different instructional model or approach. And yet there's pushback, like, I don't think I can do that. I don't think my kids can do it, right? And I'll work with high school teachers regularly who were talking about designing with station rotation, and they're very quick to tell me, oh, this, my kids won't be able to do this. I'm like, I see first graders do this. Like, your 9th and 10th grade students can absolutely do it. You're going to have to explain why you're doing it. You're going to have to walk them through the process of doing it. You're probably going to have to like be really clear about the expectations, but they are absolutely capable. Like, what I have learned in my 24 years in education is that like the minute I get out of their way, yes, there's some foundational work that needs to happen to like set them up for success, but just get out of their way and let them actively engage with each other, with concepts, with learning activities. They're amazing. They're amazingly capable. And it makes me sad when I work with teachers who are just already in that mindset of like, no, I'm going to just keep doing it this way, even though I'm not finding it very joyful or rewarding. I'm finding it kind of frustrating and exhausting. And yet they're not in that space to want to change practice. And if AI makes it possible for any teacher who was curious but didn't feel like they had the time to try something new in terms of their instructional design and facilitation, then for me,
I do think there are a lot that will help be the nudge to get them moving forward, because they'll see it as a tangible solution. I think there's a lot of them out there that maybe just didn't have the time and capacity. And now with some of these opportunities, they can.
Right.
And I'm hoping that becomes the springboard that kind of moves things into that space and that energy that starts to build up when things are exciting. And all of a sudden, maybe some people who haven't been happy are starting to get a little excited about teaching again because they're seeing a spark in their children and finding a spark in themselves again, too. I think, the system kind of beats you down. Mm-hmm. It just wears and wears and tears on you over time. And then you just wake up one day and you don't even realize that you kind of got your grumpy pants on. I think the system just kind of does that. But, I want to be respectful of your time because I could talk forever to you. You're just such a phenomenal resource and voice and advocate for such great things in education. So I thank you for that. I've been asking people on this season of the podcast, I've been trying to wrap up getting back to the human side of the guest. So I'd like to finish with two questions that I've just absolutely just been such a delight hearing people's answers. So I'm curious what you're going to have. And the first question I've been asking people is, what is one of the best pieces of advice you've ever received?
What is one of the best pieces of advice that I have ever received?
Anything you want, anything that you, however you want to approach it. Yes. It's wide open.
Honestly, I think probably if it's just open, although it definitely applies to my professional life, is just the advice of you don't have to do it all at once. I am so type A and this is great advice for teachers too, maybe listening, but there are moments when I get really excited about something or I want to do something and I get this full steam ahead mentality and then I can get really overwhelmed. And so I think whether it's my personal life or my professional life, get excited, Catlin, but start small, start with one portion of this, get through that, feel some level of success and move on to the next one. Just kind of giving myself permission not to feel like I have to do everything and do it perfectly right out of the gates, which has been, it's great advice. It's advice that I still have to constantly remind myself of.
I feel that 100. I have on my kitchen island about 30 post-it notes because I've been trying to work on the same thing of let's just do one little thing and then we throw it away and let's have a moment of joy because when I get excited, I think I need my whole world needs to be that. So that's a great reminder. And that's a piece of advice that I need to continue to work on myself. So thanks for sharing that. The second question is ending on a positive note. This does not have to be related to anything we've talked about, but again, it can. I've just been asking people to give some praise into something that's bringing you joy. So maybe that's a TV show you've been watching, a book, a music. It could be, I have heard everything under the sun and it's just awesome. So what's something that's just bringing you a bunch of joy you want to give a little praise to that maybe might be a little nudge or spark for the listeners?
Yeah, I love being physically active. And I think the thing in my life that brings me a lot of joy, I always have a little bit of an energy dip in the late afternoon, is I have my German Shepherd, Lila Grace, and I will pop in my headphones. And whether it is the latest pop music, which I listen to a ton, or whether it's a podcast, getting out and going on our 4.5 mile walk, especially in winter on the days when it's clear, is the best way for me to just kind of disconnect from my professional work and just enjoy being out and active.
I love
and
that.
Spending time with her.
I think that idea of just kind of getting grounded for a little bit, and it resonates with another guest that didn't answer this question that way, but she challenged within the conversation, just go out and notice something, go find that flower that's growing on the side of the sidewalk that you want to go look at, go walk to each day and just know as how it's blossoming or growing or whatever, just get out, get out. So that's so great.
Yeah.
This has been phenomenal. Thank you so much for your time. I know you are busy. You've got a lot of things going on. So I truly, truly am beyond grateful for you to take this time. If for some reason, by now, in this day and age, an educator has no idea that you exist or where your work is, and they want to follow you and get started. And if they haven't, I hope they do, because there is so much to be gained. Where is the best place? We'll get this in the show notes. The listeners know. Where is the best place for people to start their journey learning from you?
I would say CatelynTucker.com is the place you want to start. So that's my website. And if you're curious and you want to start reading, I blog almost every single week, and my blogs are very much intended for a teacher, coach, kind of leader audience. Lots of tips. I share tons of templates. If you want an email with like free stuff, I have an email list. And then if you have questions about anything you read, you can find me on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Catelyn_Tucker, or on Instagram. You can send me a DM with a question or a request for a resource if
Perfect.
You're looking for something specific.
I know I've said it a million times. I'll say it one more. Greatly appreciate all that you do for education, modeling, leading, sharing, putting together resources, putting the research behind it, all the stuff that goes into to helping make a difference in the lives of children and educators. So I can't thank you enough for all that you do and continue to do. And I can't thank you enough also for taking time to chat with me today. This has truly been an honor.
Oh my gosh, all of it's my pleasure. I love my work. I'm so glad we could have this conversation too.
Chaos. Woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning, chilling with coffee mugs, me and coffee chugs, talking education all across the nation, pushing boundaries, thinking innovation. Chaos.